Hello and welcome to episode 102 of Campbell Conversations with your host, Colin Campbell. And today's conversation, I'm joined by Joshua Shea, who's a coach, author, and educator. We talk about the addiction that nobody else is talking about. That is porn addiction. Expect to learn Josh's own experience with addiction, how this developed over time, and the ultimate outcome and low point that he hit before he began his recovery. Expect to learn the different triggers and life events that addicts have to alter in order to recover and the steps that need to be taken to come back from the very lowest of lows and really move forward with your life. As a published author and coach in this space, I asked Josh what trends he's seeing in the internet and what that means for porn addiction moving forward. With the internet being all-consuming, ultimately so easy to access, what will the impact be of porn use and what addiction can we expect to see in future generations? With so much porn available, I ask about the rise of paid content like OnlyFans and what it means for people who both create but also consume that content. And we have a stark conversation about what this means for both users as well as the creators. I'm delighted to say that today's podcast is supported by Crypto Glasgow. Founders Dawn and Deck have appeared in the podcast twice now and there's a third episode in store as well. They shared the principles behind the best performing investment asset of the last 12 months, that is Bitcoin, as well as the inner workings of the wider cryptocurrency market. The crypto space, quite frankly, is vast. It's growing and it's easy to get lost in the noise. It's easy to get caught up in the hype of meme coins or what's going to be the next flyer that I can make thousands of percent on. Importantly, investing in crypto does differ to other assets, and the Crypto Glasgow team have 20 plus years investing experience across all asset classes, and you can rely on their specific crypto knowledge to help navigate this market and get a handle on what on earth is actually going on. Whether you're an investor that wants to dollar cost average or somebody that wants to lump in a bit of spare cash that they've got, you can learn how the market works, what the different coin use cases are, and some of the trends that are going on within the market as well. Crypto Glasgow have got you covered with a wide range of services and products on their website to support you in this crazy world of cryptocurrency. You can visit ccgla.co.uk to learn more today. I personally use the Discord service, which is a platform like a WhatsApp where you can log in and catch up with all the different information that's going on within the market, understand some of the price targets, the sell targets, the use cases behind coins, and so much more. Whether you're into charts, whether you're an investor, whether you're a trader, there's everything you need there on the Discord. Or if you need a little bit more help, you can set up a consultation with the guys as well. There's lots on there to dive into. Before we get started with this episode, I want to say another thank you to you, the listener, who's helping us grow, have fantastic conversations with interesting guests like Josh. So please, if you are enjoying this one, pop it in your Instagram story or hover your finger over the copy and paste link to a friend on WhatsApp and tell them they need to tune into this interesting conversation, because my goodness, it certainly is that. Without any further ado, let's get into this conversation with Josh Shea. Hello and welcome back to Cambro Conversations. Today's conversation, we are going somewhere that we've not gone before in the podcast, and I'm excited to do so. We are joined by Joshua Shea, coach, author, and educator. Josh, thanks for joining me.
Thank you so much for having me, Colin. And I have to tell you something that I've noticed over the past few months is that when I do interviews and podcasts with people from Europe, they know how to pronounce my last name. Maybe it's the Irishness of it. I don't know what it is. But when I do podcasts with people here in the US or Canada, they have no idea how to say my last name. So every time I come on a European podcast, it's like, they're going to nail my name. This is going to be great. So thank you, aces.
I'm glad we've got that right. And one of the first self-development books that I really got some value from when I was younger was How to Win Friends and Influence People. And one of the teachings from Dale Carnegie was that a person's name is the most beautiful sound in the English language to them. And to get that wrong is a mark of disrespect, but I might get it wrong initially. And if you correct me, fantastic. But to get it wrong repeatedly or just not do your due diligence, like I could listen to countless interviews with you and hear how your name is properly pronounced in order to do so. But some people just don't even do the basics.
No. And what's funny is that with the coaching that I do with people, whether it's a porn addict or whether it's a partner dealing with it, there were so many times where, you know, they'll tell me about somebody pronouncing their name wrong and then being okay, or I'll pronounce it wrong and be like, oh, I'm sorry, it looks like this. They're like, oh no, that's okay, call me what you want. And I'm actually in the position to say, like, no, you correct me, you tell me that it's wrong. Because, and just here's a little coaching for everybody listening, the moment you tell somebody it's okay to pronounce your name wrong, to say your name wrong, especially if it's in the very beginning of your relationship, you are subconsciously telling them that you do not value yourself. Because while our name truthfully means nothing, it's just a matter of letters put together, usually by our parents, it's our label. And if you are not telling people to get your label right, get your label correct, you are telling them that you don't care about your label, which is essentially you. So always correct people. Always tell them that you are absolutely your name and you would prefer to be called this. And that will let people know that you have some self-respect for yourself, even if it's not working at a conscious level. It lets people know that you demand self-respect, or you demand respect.
I'm a huge fan of that. And you do see that. If we ask for our order at Starbucks and they put the wrong name on it, obviously you've not to flip at the waiter, but it's a right. case of in social interactions, as a minimum, somebody should know how to say your name. And of course, in this multicultural world we live in, we encounter people with exotic names from here, there, and everywhere. But as a fundamental point of manners and kind of gaining a mutual respect, which is exactly what you're pointing towards, giving somebody the respect so they can feel like a level of self-worth, ask their name how to pronounce it if you have a problem, and get it right.
Exactly. I have just started talking with a young woman in Belgium whose first name starts with an X. And over here in the US, that would be pronounced as Z. But I guess where she's from, it's pronounced as how we would pronounce a K. So I was saying her name incorrectly. I was starting it with the Z sound instead of a K. And she didn't tell me until halfway through our first session. I was like, okay, I need to be the last person who says this wrong. You need to step up and tell people that this is unacceptable. And she's like, you're right. And it's like, yes, these are kind of the basic things that, you know, a lot of relationships, they say you don't get a second chance to make a first impression. And that's the kind of thing people recognize if you have self-respect or not. And it's an important thing to show people that you do and that you do care for yourself. And if you don't, it's important you figure out how to get there.
Yeah, exactly that, Josh. So you mentioned as a bit of a spoiler in our discussion there that you help people who have addictions, particularly porn addictions. Why is a porn addiction the kind of one addiction that nobody's talking about?
Because it involves naked people, because it involves sex, because it involves what naked people do when they have sex. Pornography on top of that, it involves, you know, is so intricately linked to masturbation, and people don't want to talk about masturbation. And I think that pornography, despite the fact that statistics show that the vast majority of people under 50 years old look at pornography at least once a month, masturbate to pornography at least once a month, talking about that is a very personal, individual thing that we have been raised in society to believe we don't talk about, and that there is something maybe even a little wrong or perverted about it. Because let's admit, and we don't have to get into any specifics on you or I, every one of us has those little itches in the back of our head that some kind of weird porn can scratch. And especially if you're an addict like I was, you have to go to those places because the regular porn just gets boring, much like people who drink start with beer and have to move on to hard stuff, or people who gamble and develop an addiction start with, you know, $20 or $50 or move on to bigger ones. You know, pornography is the same way, but it involves all of those little things that hit us on a sexual level that maybe we're embarrassed about. Maybe that we're, you know, if you enjoy watching pornography where somebody is peeing on another person, there is nothing actually wrong with that. There's nothing illegal going on. There's nothing, you know, over the top going on, but we are all going to act, whether we feel this way or not, that kind of pornography is absolutely weird, absolutely wrong. There's got to be something wrong with you. And what I try to, when I go to colleges or to libraries or to do shows like yours, and I talk to people, I try to have them understand that while I'm not a fan of pornography, I think there are many better places that you can go to live a full life other than pornography and still get all your needs met. I am not necessarily anti-porn. What I am is pro-healthy sexuality. And I think that at the core, we are a society that doesn't know how to use pornography correctly. When I talk to parents, for instance, so many seem scared to talk about porn because they think it's the birds and the bees speech. And it's not. It's the you don't smoke cigarettes speech. It's the you don't drink alcohol when you're 12 years old speech. It's more like that. And I think that that's why so many people in our society across the world are so afraid of it, because it gets to very personal, intimate things you may not want to admit. So it's just easier to go, nope, don't watch it, don't like it, don't want to talk about it, leave me alone, freaks use it, go away. And meanwhile, they're heading home thinking, I wonder what's on Pornhub tonight. I wonder if anybody knew, if anybody I know signed up to OnlyFans this week. You know, that's the reality. And I think that if we just can admit this reality, maybe we can educate about the reality and maybe we can be healthier overall, because we're not going to eliminate pornography. That's crazy. That's stupid. Never going to happen. But maybe in today's world where we've only had this unending access to it through the internet for 25 years, and your generation doesn't even remember a world before the internet, that there's a lot of people 30 and above who are trying to catch up. And the problem is you've got this older society. I mean, and the way I describe it a lot is that they're probably two generations older than me, my parents, my grandparents. Now, my grandparents are dead, but a lot of my friends still have theirs. So you've got these two older generations. And if I think this is true, if you look across the world, they were very conservative. They were coming out of the World War I, World War II. They were very religious. Sex was wrong, taboo, you know, you didn't talk about that stuff. You know, you never saw that stuff on any TV or anywhere like that. And then you've got my generation, you know, kind of Generation X, which sort of just stood by and watched the world change. When you think about the stuff, the internet happened when I was your age. And we got, you know, suddenly we started to have 5 million TV channels. Suddenly, you know, the world radically technologically changed. All of a sudden, we all had cell phones. All, you know, all this crazy stuff happened 1998 to about 2005. But none of us knew what the results would be of it. So now we've got kids who grew up on the internet, and we didn't really know about the internet because we didn't get it till we were teenagers or in our early 20s. And now after 20 years of your generation having unending access to pornography, we're seeing the results. And they're not all good, because addiction rates are so much higher than they were 25 years ago. And it's time that we kind of act like grownups. And we say, yes, it's naked people. Yes, it's sex. Yes, this stirs our mind and this stirs our loins, but it can also be unhealthy if people don't know what they're doing with it, if people don't understand the pratfalls. And that's what I ultimately, when I talk about whether it's to kids or to adults or whatever I am talking about in this area, it's always with the idea of what could I have been told when I was 10 or when I was 17? Or when I was 23, is there anything that could have stopped me from being a porn addict? And well, I don't know. I will never have that answer. But I want to be out there and throw out information for people. And if only, you know, if two people get the information I'm saying today to you, fine, that's two more than who had it. If it's 2,000, fantastic. But I will keep going on this one-man crusade to have people understand that it's not about the porn. It's about healthy sexuality, healthy use of porn. And because sexuality is a wonderful thing. You know, you and I may not want to admit this to ourselves, but we're only here because there was one night where our parents got busy, and our kids will not want to think about it us getting busy with our partners. But that's what happens. And it's a great thing. It's nothing to be ashamed of. It's nothing to feel bad about. We need to encourage curiosity being good, but the problem is, I think with the under 30-year-old generation, or now two generations, my generation didn't know what the internet was going to do. We now have casual sexuality, casual nudity. All of these things are so prevalent in your generations that I think that we are in for a big fall if we don't start talking about it soon.
We face some huge challenges, Josh, and you've touched on so many interesting points. My mind's got lots of different loops open, but I was just wanting to take in everything that you were saying there to understand where we can go with this conversation. And that's what's so valuable about the longer form conversations we can have on podcasts, because you can just go into so much depth there, and then we're just going to pick our way through this. And top level of my mind was when you were talking about the progressive nature of addiction, and Tony Robbins has a quote, progress is happiness. And that's actually can be applied to addiction as well. As you demonstrated there with gambling, the stakes go up, what you bet goes up. With porn, what you watch gets more extreme over time in order to continue to scratch the itch to the same extent. What you drink as an alcoholic goes from, like you say, your softer drinks like your beers, which are 4%, 5%, 6% alcohol, all the way up to your spirits, because you're needing that to reach the same level of high or the same level of like stimulation from dopamine or whatever you're chasing. Now, from a porn perspective, because of the things you've called out there about the internet, we are getting closer and closer to almost unlimited access to anything that somebody wants to see. They could search anything out there, and more than likely they're going to find a website that will supply that to them and like meet their needs. And that's my probable fear when I was prepping for this podcast. Like, there is a genuine fear out there that because of the access that younger people have to this unlimited pool of whatever quirk they start to develop and start to progress with, where does it stop? And I guess your message is that we need to have more open conversations about using it at all, let alone using it in a way that becomes extreme.
Well, I think that we need to have both, because it's, like I said, it's completely natural, especially when you're, you know, 12, 13, to wonder about the body, to wonder about whether you're straight or gay or however you assign yourself, to wonder about the bodies of those who you are attracted to. I don't think there's anything strange about that. And I think that it's completely normal to want to see pornography and to be curious. I think it's completely normal to experiment with masturbation using pornography. And I'm not even going to say that people shouldn't do it. And I'm not even going to say that, you know, I know that there are millions of people who have looked at pornography for their entire lives, absolutely successfully, and have never developed a addiction. And fantastic. I know that exists. You got lucky. It's like somebody who just starts drinking. You know, people who start drinking understand that there are alcoholics out there. You start smoking cigarettes. There's no one on this earth who would start smoking cigarettes and not know what the dangers are. You can still make the bad choice or you can make the good choice, but you know what they are. We are not in a world where pornography addiction and the fallout is understood. Because, yeah, like you just brought up, any 8-year-old kid can spell horse, you know, screws woman, sheep screws man. And when I was a kid, you know, if you told me that stuff actually happened, I'd be, oh my God, you're going to be kidding me. Really? People don't do that. What? Maybe one sicko off, you know, in New Zealand screwed a sheep once, whatever. But if you're 8 years old and you can type man screws sheep, I guarantee you, you're probably going to find all the sheep screwing videos you could ever want in your life. And while you and I may laugh and obviously, hopefully not go look at that stuff, you know what? As a 9-year-old kid, that sounds out there. What if you stumble upon that? What if you get there? And that's really why I think we need to start talking about this, because kids have unending access to it. And the other thing that's really come up during this pandemic, which scares me, is not just how the numbers of people consuming porn have exploded, the numbers of people making porn have exploded with things like OnlyFans. You know, January 1st, 2020, there were 300,000 people worldwide, including 100,000 people in the UK making pornography, because OnlyFans is based in the UK. However, just recently, the CEO said that there are 2 million content creators. So that means, when you and I are taping this about, you know, towards the end of 2021, over the last 18 to 20 months, 1.7 million more people have joined and are producing and selling their own pornography through OnlyFans. That doesn't talk about other cam sites. That doesn't talk about Fansly. It doesn't talk about all the other places where I can only imagine what the number is. Now, look at my, when I got into porn, the 80, late 80s, early 90s, all I had was magazines. All I had to find a videotape. Now you can literally watch your next door neighbor getting busy with themselves through OnlyFans. It is such a different world that we live in, and we don't even understand what's happening. You know, we now know what's happening to people who have consumed porn for 15, 20 years through the internet. We don't know what happens if you make porn for 15 years through the internet. Yeah, how different is pornography addiction from the consuming end and the producing end? Might the legacy of this pandemic be not how many people started watching porn, but how many people started making porn? And you can't tell me, I don't know what the fallout is, but you can't tell me that there's not going to be a significant portion of those people who have some kind of issue later on that is either exacerbated or created by producing and distributing their own pornography. Don't know what's going to happen to those people.
I agree. I want to put a pin in OnlyFans just now and come back to it, but I certainly think people will have a gratification problem because they're seeking gratification through either fiscally, but also the attention that they'll gather from people wanting to see them naked. But we will definitely come back to that, Josh. And I think to really bring this to life would be to dive into when you started to realize that you yourself had a problem with porn. You spoke there that you first got acquainted with it through magazines and maybe renting a videotape or finding a videotape. So access was so much more difficult. But how did that start to build to become a problem?
Well, you know, I am typical of most addicts where I have abuse in my background. I had a babysitter from 3 to 7 years old who was not only sexually abusive, but she was also mentally and emotionally abusive for several years. I know that I didn't process that stuff well at that age. And when you look at male porn addicts specifically, because that's where most of the studies are done, male porn addicts, over 70% have some kind of unresolved trauma because of physical abuse. Over 80% have some kind of trauma that's unresolved based on sexual abuse. Almost 95% has some kind of trauma based on emotional or mental abuse. So when you look at porn addicts, statistically, they should have one, if not all three, types of repressed trauma from abuse. And that's really what the core of it is. And, you know, if you're 28, if you're 42, you know you can go get help, you know you've got problems. Well, if it's 1982 and you're 5 or 6 years old, well, you maybe don't know how to go get help. You don't even know help is a real thing. You don't know what's happening to you. All you're trying to do is survive the day. And that was my life for a long time. And when I was 12 years old, I was exposed to hardcore pornography for the first time. And it wasn't like, oh, okay, this is cool. I'm going to look at this. No, it was like a lightning bolt hit me. It was like a warm feeling came over me. And I tell you, Colin, I don't remember what was on the page. I don't remember what the magazine was. I just remember this feeling of relief like I'd never felt before, that I had found the answer to my problems. And the only other time that's ever happened was 2 years later when I was 14 years old and I got drunk at a wedding for the first time. And suddenly it's, oh, this is why people do this. I feel better. And I don't know how much angst and anxiety and all this I had at 14, but I recognize this makes me feel good. And from 14 years old up until 37, when I got into treatment, didn't matter if I was where I was in school, didn't matter where I was in my career. I could be with nobody. I could have a girlfriend. I could be married. I could not have my kids yet, have my kids yet. Didn't matter what was going on in my life. I knew that I could count on two things, pornography and alcohol, because when things got tough and I couldn't cope with the world and I went back to that little kid who couldn't cope with what was happening with me there, you look at the timeline of my life. When it got harder, when it felt like I had less control, when I was more stressed, my drinking and my pornography shot way up. because that's how alcohol numbed me. Pornography made me feel powerful and like I had control. And that was the illusion I had to create for myself, was that I had my stuff together. And it's tough, but that's what happens with addicts most of the time. You're not using because it's an awesome high, or maybe it is at the beginning. You're using to just maintain your life and just keep your stuff together.
Yeah, they're crutches that you lean on.
Absolutely.
In order to stay at a base level. And I know with addiction that your levels will fall to like chronic levels where you're suffering. And then the little bump that you get from reusing brings you back up to normal, or what you experience as normal. And that is like, it's the worst possible thing, because it makes you think that that makes things better, when actually that's just going to cause the next crash again. And we see this a lot with phone addiction, people continually looking at their screens and not realizing that, and like they almost have to ride out the unpleasant feelings of withdrawal in order to re-establish a relationship with that. And I can only imagine that's considerably worse when it comes to porn.
It's funny you say that, because when I do talk to groups or people say, you know, what does addiction feel like? I always tell them, tomorrow morning, pull out your phone, turn up all of the alerts, every Instagram, Snapchat, Facebook, text, everything that makes a ding or a buzz, turn the volume, no more of this vibrating stuff, turn the volume up all the way on everything, and then take a piece of paper and tape it to the front of your phone, and then put the phone next to you. Every time you hear a chime, if you're like most people, you're going to, ooh, what's this? Attention. Oh, what? I can't look at it. Okay. A text came in. Wait, that may be important. Maybe I should lift up the paper to look at it. No, you can't. You can't, because you're a phone addict. You can't do it. Most people who have tried this either last, especially younger people, last about an hour and a half, or last about 7 alerts. And then they're so freaked and they literally look like they're going into withdrawals. They're like, yeah. They have to rip the paper off. And I said, there, you have a phone addiction. You were able to last 90 minutes. Now imagine my addictions are probably 20 times worse than that. And I have to try to get through my days, and I have to try to be highly functional. And I have to put on an appearance to the world so they don't know that, because I can't be doing all day long. I need to, you know, figure out a way to hide this from people and still get at it. And that's how a lot of people, I think, can understand addiction, because we all have different levels of habits, compulsions, addictions. We just have this basket of stuff we put in the addictions basket. It's drugs, it's alcohol, it's gambling. And the reality is, in my opinion, I see it as, you know, routine, habit, bad habit, compulsion, addiction. And with different things in life, we fall on that scale. You know, if you're addicted to coffee, there are things that are bad about that. There are also things that you do get, you know, the lift from the caffeine, whatnot. But obviously, it's not as dangerous as some of the things we put in that basket. So we don't talk about coffee addiction. We talk about coffee as your bad habit, because it doesn't quite rise to the level of addiction. But we all have these, and it's important for us to recognize that we all have these. It doesn't mean you have to do anything about it. If it's an addiction, I hope you will. But it's just important to know yourself enough and look at your routines and look at your patterns to see if you have any that are unhealthy. And I guarantee you, your relationship with your phone, if you're under 30 years old, is probably not super healthy.
Brilliant example, Josh, and I'm so glad you brought it to light. I'm a bit of a advocate of digital minimalism in some way to try and rewire what's going on, because particularly when you are a younger person, like you say, the majority of the audience will be under 30 or under 35 at least. I was only introduced to my smartphone in terms of probably like second or third year at university, which is like 19, 20 years of age. I had a phone before that had access to the internet, but it was slow and not very clunky and quite clunky. But now, obviously, just a total game changer. But you mentioned there that you, and I guess a lot of this is from the self-work that you've done since, you recognized that it was like a bolt from the blue that hit you in this positive way, this feeling of warmth that you got from both alcohol, but also from your first experience of porn. When did you realize it was starting to become a problem?
I realized that I looked at porn differently probably about 4 or 5 years after I started using, because I grew up in a very religious household. My parents are very, like I said, the old people older than me are much more conservative. And, you know, it's ironic because we had HBO in the early 80s when it started. So my mom would let us watch, you know, a Sylvester Stallone Rambo movie or a war movie like Apocalypse Now and not think about it. Yet if there's some lighthearted comedy, yet you see somebody's butt in the first 5 minutes, turn that off. You just saw somebody's ass. My God, you are going to be shattered for life. And it's like, Mom, I just watched like 96 people get killed. And I can look back now and go, and they were all not white. Maybe that's a problem. Is that really a problem? You know, if I see somebody's butt, but that's the way she was raised. So she raised me that certain way. And I think that's where you get, that's where at least I got a lot of my messaging was from my parents, that this was something that was bad. It was different. But then when I got into it, I kind of liked it. It kind of made me feel good. There's something that I enjoyed looking at naked girls. And I recognized that not only could I not tell my parents, I couldn't tell my friends. Because one day, and I was on the soccer team, I think you kids call it football over there. Tottenham's playing right now. My son just sent me a text saying I can't talk to him for the next 2 hours because Tottenham's got a game. He likes losers, what can I say? I feel like I was kind of caught in this weird spot because I recognized my friends were watching it differently than me, but I didn't know what that meant. After our soccer practice one day, we went back to one of their houses, and I don't know if you remember the old show Mystery Science Theater 3000, where it was a couple robots and a person watching old bad movies and just making comments like you do with your friends when you watch TV or sports or whatever. And what was interesting was they were all sitting there doing this. Somebody had a VHS porno film when we were like 16 or 17 after practice. We were six or seven of us guys at their house, and they popped it in and they were making jokes about it. No, the music's funny and this acting's horrible. And oh my God, people don't bend like that. All this. And I wasn't, and I'm the biggest one-liner jokester you will find. I think I sometimes piss off podcast hosts because I don't take this as seriously as they want me to, and I don't make it as sad and dark as they want me to, because it's more fun being happy. But nonetheless, these guys made me feel uncomfortable because, oh my goodness, they're laughing, they're joking. So I'm thinking to myself, I want you all to be gone. I want to watch this on my own. I want to pleasure myself to this. With all of you gone, this is not how I consume pornography. I look at this. This would be like if you put a table full of cocaine in front of some Colombian drug lord, and the guys are like, "Oh, look at all that!" And you're thinking, "My God, we can cut this up. We can sell it. You guys do not see what this is." And it's like that's kind of the way I felt. Was how are you all watching it like this when I want to do something so very different? So I recognized I was different then. I had some girlfriends as I got older who were okay with porn. Some liked it. I mean, it never led to some weird Caligula type situations, but it was still, you know, they were okay with it. And then I had some who were very anti-porn, and I had to hide my use from them, but I could never stop, even if I tried. And when I got married, my wife ended up being one of those women who is, well, boys will be boys, and there's nothing too wrong with porn. She's watched porn before. It's okay. So if I was ever looking at porn on my laptop and my browser was left open, she didn't freak out. She's just like, oh, can you please close your browser so the kids don't find it? You know, or please erase your history in case the kids sit down. So it was not a big deal. She had no idea the extent of my addiction. And in a weird way, being an alcoholic helped, because you can't hide alcoholism nearly as well as you can hide porn addiction. Think about it. It's so much easier to hide that you are a gambling addict than a cigarette addict. Think about it, because you smell, You know, with alcohol, you slur, you might walk funny. It changes your personality afterwards. It's a social activity, usually, for a lot of people. Well, porn isn't like that. People, I think, in my general community and in my family recognized I had issues with alcohol because it's harder to hide them. If you're not looking for a process addiction, like porn addiction, gambling addiction, video game addiction, these process addictions are almost impossible to tell from the surface because people don't have physical side effects usually to them. It doesn't impair them in other ways. The side effects of these addictions are not the same as side effects with chemical addictions. So it's easy to fly under the radar. So yeah, you know what? A lot of people may saw me as Josh, the guy who drank too much, but Josh, the guy who drank too much, it was easier to play him and hide the guy who I really was.
Yeah, that's incredibly insightful, isn't it? Because like you say, so much more difficult to hide that element of your lifestyle. But what goes on behind closed doors with you in front of a laptop is much easier to hide because everyone uses their laptop at some point after work or during their lunch break, whatever it is. You have time alone by yourself, and what you choose to do with that is your own prerogative. But that outlet for you was unhealthy. And one of the burning questions I had was, many would assume that an addict to porn would not have access to real women. That would be like the immediate reaction, wouldn't it? Oh, they maybe just look at porn because they never have sex. But that's not the case. If you were a married man with children, of course you're having
I've traveled this world many times, and I have not had I'm not going to pretend that, you know, I'm a rock star, but I do not complain in the area that I was in sexually before I got married. Now, the thing is, when you look at like sex addicts, most sex addicts did start with pornography, but very few porn addicts actually evolve into sex addicts. So there is a difference between the two. And what I tell people is that there are a couple angles here. First is that sitting in front of a laptop, looking at the greatest naked bodies in the world, pleasuring yourself like nobody else knows how to pleasure you, still doesn't compare to being, you know, in a bed with another naked person who actually likes you. That is intimate. That is, you know, skin to skin. That is so different. The only thing those two things have in common is usually an orgasm at the end. And that's really it. So many people, especially partners who I have to coach, make that mistake of, was I not enough in bed? And I tell them, okay, we're going to get that out of the way immediately, because I met my wife at 26 years old. I became a porn addict at 12. I had 14 years of porn addiction before I met her. What could she have possibly done? That doesn't exist. And the other aspect that a lot of people don't realize, and I get it, because nudity, pornography, sex, it seems like they all go together. You know, intercourse, all that, seems like they go together very neatly, very nicely, but that isn't the case. There is a big difference. And you have to remember, we're talking about addiction. We're not talking about casual use of pornography. Somebody who's not an addict sits down to get off for 15 minutes to Pornhub. That's how most people use pornography. Somebody like me, when I was in my full-blown addiction, I would promise myself I'd look for 15 minutes and then I'd look for 2 hours. And I couldn't find that perfect piece of porn to finish with that I was looking for. And it was not the same as somebody who wasn't an addict. So that's an important thing to recognize, because especially for partners, because if you look at heroin addicts, gambling addicts, any type of addict straight across the board, you will always find that their libido drops. So it's very easy for a partner to say, oh my God, my boyfriend, my girlfriend, they don't want to have sex with me. And that's because they're a porn addict. They're getting what they want out of the pornography. And that's not the case. Their libido has dropped. Their addictive use has nothing to do with the sex. I saw some crazy shit on the page or on the screen that never registered with me, because I was just looking for whatever would tickle the upstairs enough to cause the dopamine release, the oxytocin release, all of those different chemicals. And that's really the big difference between addiction and casual use, is that you are serving a different animal. You know, porn addiction doesn't take place in your crotch. It takes place in your brain. Just wanting to get off takes place in your crotch. And then there's a big difference between the two. You know, I don't know exactly why it was porn addiction that I went towards. I don't know exactly why it was alcohol that I went towards, but that was what I needed to cure the storm in my brain. And that's what I try to tell people, is it doesn't matter what the word is before addiction: heroin, gambling, sex, porn, you know, video games. We are all serving the same masters in our mind. Addiction is 95% the same from addiction to addiction to addiction to addiction. It's a certain release of certain chemicals. The closest thing to porn addiction, as far as the chemical makeup, next closest addiction is cocaine addiction. So that's where it goes. And that's the thing, is that there's so much going on inside the body that for those people who aren't addicts and are like, oh my God, just close the browser, there's a girl in your bed. Well, yeah, I understand there's a girl in my bed and I can go have sex with her, and or I can make love and she can be the love of my life. That doesn't mean that that cured the storm in my head. That's why I'm an addict, is because I have to cure that storm. And having sex with my partner who I love is so different than just sitting in front of a computer and masturbating. Two different worlds. The only thing is they end with an orgasm, so people confuse them as the same thing.
Such important distinctions there between, like you say, sex and the masturbation to the porn, because the porn is driven, like you say, by what's going on inside your head. It's not to do with your libido. And I can only imagine the number of couples that say to you about loss of libido, or maybe, and this is one of the things that I was thinking about, was even with casual use, like our taste and like our fetish and like our idealization of what sex should look like can become more extreme. But with porn addiction, it seems that it's not always the most important thing what's on the screen. It's more about, and for you it was control, it's more about moving towards scratching the itch that's going on inside the head, rather than maybe like a particular kind of like activity that is ticking that box.
It doesn't matter what's on the screen. You know what? If one guy and one girl is going to do it for me today as an addict, great. Maybe it needs to be three girls. Maybe it needs to be three girls of different colors. Maybe it needs to be three she-males. And that's one of the reasons why I always tell people, especially young people, is you are not the porn you look at. It's okay to look, as long as it's legal, it's okay to look at it. It's okay. You know, I don't expect you to start peeing on your girlfriends or boyfriends, you know, that because you look at that, because that interests you, because that tickles your brain, that doesn't mean that's who you are. And that's an important thing to realize, because I deal with so many partners like, oh my God, I looked at his phone and I saw gay porn. And it's like, okay, well, that either means he's attracted to men, or that means that he is so far down the rabbit hole of addiction, he will look at anything, because it's not even about two guys or two girls or a guy and a girl. It's about finding whatever is on that screen that hits you in the head. And that's what you hear from a lot of real late stage addicts, is that I sat down to look at porn for an hour. I looked up at the clock and 6 hours were gone, and I was not any closer to finishing, because I didn't find that perfect piece of porn. And that perfect piece of porn, it doesn't matter what it is. It just happens to be the one that causes the chemical rush, because that's what you're after. It's like when you go buy drugs, you know, heroin, when you go buy coke, do you care who you're buying it from? No. Do you care where it was made, how it was processed? No. You care about the high. And that's all I cared about. So, I mean, I can't even register most of the time what I was looking at, because it didn't matter. It was a means to an end.
One of the common assumptions, I think, when I or other people think about a porn addict, is that young guy, 19, 20, in his mum's basement, dropped out of college because he's spending 5-6 yeah. hours a day watching porn. He probably plays a lot of video games as well. That's the immediate assumption. How did you buck that trend and manage to live out a relatively successful life at this stage?
I lived in a world where we didn't know porn addiction was a thing. I mean, the weird reality is the first time I went to rehab in 2014, early 2014, I went for alcohol. And it was about halfway through my stay there. I was at the facility for 10 weeks. It was 5 or 6 weeks into my stay that my caseworker said to me, "Are you familiar with pornography addiction?" And I was like, "I know sex addiction. I've never heard of that." It's like, "I think you have an issue with this. Just the little bits you've told me." And he was a cool guy, also a former alcoholic. So I trusted him. He asked me to meet with a friend of his who was a certified sex addiction therapist off campus. I met this guy and he made me realize, number one, porn addiction is a real thing. Number two, I actually had it. And number three, it predated the alcohol. And if I you know, did my timeline, which I've done a couple times now, those times when I had the least amount of control and felt like I was spinning out of control, that's when I used the most porn, because porn was a surrogate for control. And it makes sense when you think about it. Think about sitting down and you look at, say, the open the first page of Pornhub. You've got all of those little thumbnails. You've got a list of 100 different categories. I mean, and some of which are flat out scary sounding. But you are the master of your world. You want to watch BDSM? Boom, there it is. You want to watch, you know, three Asians, three Latinos, and three white people have an orgy? Boom, there it is. You can watch whatever you want, and nobody on the screen is ever going to say, "Hey, it's time to take the trash out," or, "Hey, you're 15 minutes late to work. You better work 15 minutes late." Nobody is there to nag you. And most importantly, nobody on that screen is ever going to say no to you. You can have the wildest sex with the wildest people in the wildest situations, even though, you know, we know it's totally fake. Sometimes you can fool your brain into thinking otherwise. And if you don't like what you're looking at, you hit the button and you find something else. And is there any better, you know, control in the world than being the master of your own sexual universe where nobody can say no to you? That's the porn that we have these days. And the thing with OnlyFans, which I think is going to come down to be known as a company that absolutely changed this world, OnlyFans broke that final barrier down. They gave an easy way for you to see porn of people you know. And that was the last genre in my thought, was porn of people you know. And not just that, but porn of people you know when we're all stuck at home. And it's just, it's such a weird place we are in the world today that we need to have these conversations. And like I said, I'm not anti-porn. I'm not trying to stop sexuality. Porn has been around forever. Some of the earliest cave paintings are pornography. Go into any of your great museums and go to the ancient medieval exhibit. Look at the pottery. There's some pretty heavy-duty triple X-rated stuff painted on there. The greatest sex manual, sex position manual in the world, comes from the super conservative country of India, known as the Kama Sutra. India just tried to ban pornography so no one could see it. They did not do a good job. They're still the second biggest consumer of pornography after the US in the world. You're not going to get rid of pornography ever. What we need to do is teach people how to use it. And you can't guilt people and shame people into not using it. They tried that in the 70s and 80s. It didn't work. Nobody, and I hate to say this, but it's absolutely true. Nobody has ever stopped looking at porn because of, "Oh my God, was this person trafficked?" Hey, we all know trafficking is a bad thing. When we're looking at porn, we're not thinking of that. We're not thinking about, "Oh my goodness." You know, I remember when I was younger, I was like, "The actors in pornography are all drug addicts, and they're only doing this because they're forced to get their drugs. They hate their job, they hate their life, and they're hooked on drugs." It's like, well, you've just described everybody who works in the kitchen at McDonald's. You know, pornography does not have the cornerstone on employees who don't like their profession. Most of us are like that in this world. There is no good argument for the person who is sitting down to look at porn to stop, other than their personal health. How does it personally affect them? And that's what we need to do, is start talking about that and not say, "Bad, pervert, stop looking, gross." What we need to say is, "Hey, if you're going to use this stuff, understand that there is a percentage of people who are susceptible to addiction and who are susceptible to other things. And as long as you know about that and you can keep using this in a safe way, I can't stop you because it's legal, but at least know what you're getting into.
Yeah, exactly that, Josh. It's very interesting how people who've had their own challenges in different areas then go on to become coaches and helpers in that area. But at what point did your porn use hit its most troubling period that ultimately led to you having to recover?
That was probably when the police showed up. That seemed like the real obvious. You know, what's funny is I say that was rock bottom. It was probably 10 minutes before that, when I was still locked into my addiction, when the police showed up at my house back in early 2014, I had no idea why they were there. And it turned out that my addiction had really grown into a critical place, to the point where not only was I not even masturbating to pornography, I was just looking at it. I didn't have 12 hours a day. So I would just look. There was no longer ejaculating coming with it. And looking at a screen at a video no longer did it for me. So I started going into chat rooms and I started trying to manipulate women into behaving certain ways. I found out several months later that one of those women was a teenage girl. And when the police showed up and told me, and, you know, I have to deal with the fact that I was very inappropriate with a teenage girl at one point. Any kind of excuse that I didn't know how old she was or she didn't tell me is a bunch of bullshit, because I know, and you know, that there are 15 and 16 year old girls who look 25 and 26, and there are 25 and 26 year old girls who look 15 or 16. That's not an excuse. The fact that I was not at my mental health best was not an excuse. There is no excuse for what I did, but thank God I had that wake up call when the police showed up and said, "Hey, we have reason to believe that you have communicated with an underage woman online." I was like, "What?" And they were able to link it up and do it. And then they proved it to me. I couldn't say I didn't do it. But that's what happened. And that was the day. I remember when they showed up at my door and I learned why they were there. And I said to myself, "Oh my God, my life is going to be different forever." It only took me about an hour after talking to these police officers, sitting in my living room. We were all very chill, very cool with each other. I made them coffee because what are you going to do? I mean, they had me and they proved it to me. I didn't even know I did this and they proved it to me. So we had a really good conversation. It was the first time that I ever talked openly about my porn use. And I told them, "Here's how I do this. Here's what I say. And they're like, "Oh my God, you could teach a class on this." And I said, "Well, you know, if you have any other questions." And it was funny because I almost showed them how somebody like me does this. You know, I was never a "show me your boobs" type of guy. I would rather find somebody who didn't want to do it and then manipulate them for 2 hours into doing it. Because to me, that was a success. That was the challenge. There's no challenge in, you know, "Hey, I've got beads, show me your boobs."
That links into what you said at the start about porn was your ability to have control.
Yeah, exactly. And the thing is, what's even weirder is if I couldn't get a woman to bend to my sexual will, I would start doing other things like, "Hey, can I see your closet? Oh, that's a pretty red dress. Can I see what you look like in that?" If they didn't want to do that, I might start saying like, "You know, I don't like that painting on the wall. Might that painting look better over there? Oh, let me try." And I mean, and this is how sick I was. And that's why I say it was all about manipulation. It was all about control. If I could control you somehow online, whether it was sex, whether it was just moving around whatever it was, I had so little control in my own life that if I went to bed at 3 o'clock in the morning, 4 o'clock in the morning, and I made you hang a painting somewhere different, and I spent 3 hours doing it, that felt like a success to me. And that's how messed up I got. So it doesn't surprise me that I drifted into underage territory. It's so wrong. It's, you know, I have to live with it. But I did go to jail for 6 months. And it was in jail where I met people who were like me. Only through the grace of God, of my parents not being complete screw-ups, having gone to college, having had good jobs, that I had the resources for rehabs. I had the resources for good therapy. When I went to jail 2 years after I was arrested, And by that point, I had been through two rehabs. I'd done hundreds of hours of therapy. I had done lots of research. When I went to jail, I was the healthiest version of myself I had ever been, ironically. And I met all kinds of men who had issues with sex, who had issues with pornography. And just because they were lower income, lower socioeconomic, they didn't have access to resources to get better that I did. So in jail, I became the de facto porn and sex coach there. That was the first time I did that. I wrote my first book sitting in jail. It was in jail meeting these other men who, again, they just drew poorly in the DNA lottery. I got lucky to have the parents I did in the situation I did that could help me get the resources I needed. These guys didn't have it. That's when I decided that I had to create resources that the average guy on the street could go online and find. I needed to, I've got a client who I coach. She and her husband just left a marriage counselor who they were paying $700 an hour to. Wow. You know, I charge just slightly more than 10% of that. And I couldn't imagine charging the richest person more than that. And I have a sliding scale, and the poor people I charge next to nothing, because I truly believe everybody should have access to this kind of help. And it was only in going to jail, it was only in having that time of reflection, of working with men who I didn't meet in my rehabs. I met people who had resources. I met pro athletes. I met doctors and lawyers. And that was great, because it proved to me that everybody was a porn addict. You know, when there's that 62-year-old grandmother who's also a nurse who is a porn addict, well, hell, if she's a porn addict, anybody can be. That was proven again when I went to jail and I met some of the realest people I'd ever met. And, you know, it, like I said, it's always going to be partly embarrassing, partly shameful. I hate the fact of why I ended up there, but the police showing up at my door it saved my life. I don't think I'd be here with you if I hadn't been talking to them. And while they were, I saw them as devils at my door. Oh my God, they're here to change my life. It did not take very long before I realized maybe they were actually angels there to save my life. And yeah, I got publicly shamed. You can go online and read all about it. I lost my job. I lost a ton of friends, but I am on the other side of this now, nearly 10 years later, so much healthier, so much happier. And I just want people to recognize that they're probably listening to us, especially a lot of guys your age and in that 25 to 35 year old group, who probably think to themselves, yeah, I look at porn, but I can never get this far down the road. Well, the reality is, for 23 of my 24 years of a porn addiction, I couldn't go this far. Going into a chat room, that's cheating on my wife. Talking to a woman like that is cheating on my wife. Masturbating to a woman who's stripping for me, whether she's 18 or 27 or 86, is cheating. I never could have, even though I had a pornography addiction, I never saw it as moving into cheating territory till I started being interactive. And I was so ill at that time, and I was not thinking about cause and effect, that I went down that road. That bothers me more than the fact that one of the girls happened to be 16. What bothers me more is that I cheated on my wife. I never could have got to that point. So I want the young guys listening, oh, okay, well, this guy certainly had a problem. That went too far. Yes. And for 23 years, it never could have. So just recognize that you never know how far it can go.
You were also high functioning though, Josh. You were an elected politician in your local council. You had your own business. How did you manage these pursuits alongside needing hours a day to watch porn?
I used to say a half-hearted joke to people when they said exactly what you did, because people in my community were like, oh my God, there aren't 40 hours in a day. How do you stay awake? How do you do? You have three full-time jobs, and you're supposed to be a father and a husband and, you know, all this other stuff. And it's like, the joke I always told people was, well, if you knew that I still use half my energy just to keep my shit together from going crazy, you would really be impressed. And they would laugh and all that. But the reality is, so much of my energy did go into keeping things together. And I think that I did this almost as escape, because, you know, I could, when I was by myself after everybody's in bed, after the world's gone to sleep, when it's 2 a.m. and I'm sitting up and I'm drinking and I'm looking at porn, I am truly alone. I am truly isolated. While most addicts love to isolate, I recognize that's when I got to my bad place. So I tried to be I tried to be busy 24/7. And I tried to escape and almost isolate myself in massive projects. Okay, in 6 months, I have to put on a film festival for 20,000 people. Well, how the hell do I do that? First time out, I didn't know, but hey, we'll figure it out. That'll keep me away from acting up. And eventually, as is the way with addiction, if you don't deal with your addiction, it doesn't end well. Addiction never ends well. You lose your family and friends. You end up in financial ruin, you know, losing your job. You end up with some kind of physical ailment, or you end up in trouble with the law. And usually it's more than one of those things at the same time. Your only other option before one of those things happen is to get help. Because if you don't get help, thankfully, I didn't end up dead. 5 more years, I probably would have. But usually addiction, if untreated, ends up in death. And it doesn't matter what addiction, because you just end up finding the next thing and the next thing. And I couldn't tell you that I wouldn't have ended up a heroin addict. Maybe I would have.
Moving on from 2014 and these massive changes, the police at your door, time in jail, rehab, what triggers and life events have you had to like cut out and change in order to sustain your new clean life?
Early on, what you have to do is change the routines. For instance, you know, I could not be left alone out in the living room with my laptop or my phone. Now, I've got bipolar disorder. I've had it since, you know, I was diagnosed 20 years ago. It runs to the manic, if you can't tell. And it means still to this day, I only need 4 or 5 hours of sleep. And I can get by on 2 or 3 hours for a day or two if I need to. So I'm still the last one who goes to bed in my household. I'm still the first who gets up in my household. But I had to cut out the computer and the phone for years and years. I had to make sure HBO and Cinemax were not offerings on our cable situation anymore, because I didn't want to be flipping through channels and then suddenly there's some woman dry humping a guy in one of those cheesy softcore movies. Not that I'd watch that, but because I'd go find my phone and keep going, because it never is just, oh, I'll take a quick look. It's not that for an addict. So I had to do these kinds of things. Now, I hadn't been triggered by anything in a couple of years until recently. About a month and a half ago, my favorite baseball team was in the playoffs and I got tickets. I went to see them and I went with my brother, who's a couple years younger than me. And last time I was at that ballpark, he pointed out to me, was 11 years earlier. And as I was walking towards the ballpark, I saw the restaurants and the bars around it. And I'm walking towards, I'm like, I remember getting drunk there. And oh, I missed half a game once because I got drunk until the fifth inning there. And oh, I missed a complete game there once. I remember that. And, oh, I remember once I got completely wasted there, didn't realize it was a rain delay, left the bar thinking the game was over and it was only the second inning. And I felt like I had won a victory because I didn't black out. It was a rain delay. And we walked there and he looked at me and he said, I can tell you're feeling this. And it was like, this is weird. I haven't had a trigger in a couple of years. This is wild. And thankfully I have the tools now to deal with them. But in early recovery, a lot of it really is developing tools and techniques and changing your patterns. That's one of the things that people really fight about with me when I'm coaching them is that, well, I sit down and I watch TV every night. It's like, well, that's fine. You can do that. Put your phone in the other room. Well, what if somebody calls me? Well, you'll hear it. Do any porn stars call you? Because if they do, you need to tell them to stop calling you. And you know what? If you miss a phone call, I'll tell you what we did back in my day. We waited for the phone call to happen again. Because I promise you, if somebody is dead, when they get in touch with you in half an hour, they'll still be dead. There is no emergency that you are going to miss that can't wait for 30 minutes or an hour, and people will find you another way. Do not make excuses. Do not throw up hurdles. Do not throw up roadblocks to your recovery. You need to embrace it and you need to follow what the experts and follow what those who were successful before you suggest. I know we all like to think of ourselves as renegades who blaze our own path and we know what it is. And yes, in recovery, you will figure out what works best for you. But in very early recovery, listen to the experts and break your cycles, break your routines. Everybody, it's not just about the addiction itself. It's not just about porn, because porn is used for me to soothe. Well, do you know what else was really soothing to me back in the day? Hearing that sound the modem makes. Fax machines still make the same noise. I hear a fax machine someplace and I immediately go back to AOL 1995 and oh my God, I can look at porn. That's what I hear when I hear the fax machine noise. You know, some of these things are ritual. And that's what I tell people is it's not just about sitting down and looking at the porn. When I hear the fax sound, I still get a little Pavlov dog reaction to, ooh, porn. That's probably always going to be with me. So what do I need to do when I hear, oh, porn? What do I do to not go there? That's what you have to develop. And early in recovery, it is about totally disrupting all of your routines, creating new, hopefully healthier routines, and then doing the hard work of the trauma work. Because ultimately, addiction is just a symptom of the trauma. Nobody really becomes an addict because it's fun. You become a recreational user from it's fun. You go out and get drunk with your friends once a month. That doesn't mean you're an alcoholic. You just like to do it. And maybe it gets a little too bad. If you're out there by yourself every night doing it to escape your problems, well, that is an issue we need to talk about because you're drinking for a different reason. In the first scenario, you go out with your friends because you're so social. You like your friends. You have a good time. You know, fantastic. That is not why the addict uses. So if you can take care of and do the hard work on why the addict uses, why did you become an addict? If we can figure that out, well, doesn't it stand to reason if you resolve that, you won't need to do the behavior of being an addict? And I went through this. I've seen so many people go through this along with me. And now I help people go through this. It's amazing how when you tackle some of those demons of your past, you don't need them anymore. I tell people it's like a Band-Aid. You have a big gash. Well, that's your addiction. You put Band-Aids on it, or you have a big gash. That's your trauma. You put Band-Aids on it. That's your addiction. Your addiction is hiding the problem, but it's not fixing it. You're going to have to rip off those Band-Aids, go in, treat the wound. And once you've treated the wound, you don't actually need the Band-Aids. And that's kind of how I look at addiction is you need to deal with the underlying issue because addiction is only a symptom of something bigger.
So powerful, Josh. And I can relate so strongly to those initial stages where you're trying to manipulate environment, habits, routines, because one of my favorite books is James Clear, Atomic Habits. And it's a really strong guide to dictating how we make changes to our behavior. But ultimately you can only do that for the short term to enable that absolute. Right. To give you the time and the chance to work on the trauma. So no, really, really well explained. And I'm going to pull the pin back out on OnlyFans before we wrap up. My concern with OnlyFans and the way you've put it is very interesting because people are getting this buzz both financially, but from a dopamine and an attention perspective of I'm creating content behind a paywall. People are paying to watch me. I'm creating this content for them, but also for fiscal gain. You raise an important point. It could well become an addictive experience for them to chase this high of I get paid X number of £1,000 per month or X number of $1,000 per month to create this content. And that is a slippery slope because you've articulated exactly how addiction can move towards that.
Well, and I'll tell you, for the most recent book I did about the pandemic that came out last year, when I started writing it, I interviewed a bunch of OnlyFans and cam models who were veterans, and I interviewed a bunch of newbies who were just getting into it because of the pandemic. About 8 weeks later, when I was finishing my research and reporting, I talked to these same people again. The people who were veterans, they were still all about the money, and they could tell me how the consumer had changed. How has the customer changed in the first couple months of the pandemic? And we had some fascinating conversations. When I started to talk to some of the newbies, and these are the 19-year-old guys and 20-year-old girls who this is a whole new world to them, what I started to hear really troubled me, because especially with some of the younger women, because what I heard was like, I can't get a boyfriend in real life. Guys don't like me, or nobody has ever told me that I'm pretty. And now I've got men who, you know, are telling me how beautiful I am. I've got men who want to fly me all over the world to see them. Or, you know, I don't feel special. I can't get a date. And I never liked my body. And now men are sending me, you know, $500 and lingerie to model for them. And it makes me feel so special. It makes me feel so important. And what I'm hearing is like you said, they are so addicted to the love. They're addicted to the attention. They're addicted to the idea of taking off your clothes and whatever, which might have been a little bit of a hurdle for them early on, is gone because they are getting their pleasure centers hit, and it has nothing to do with money. And what scares me is that, you know, in the 1980s or 90s, when I became of age, what was it, maybe 1,000 porn stars in the world, because, you know, out in California. Well, we now in this world have, geez, over 2 million porn stars, or at least 2 million people who are creating and distributing and making money off of their own pornography. Something's going to happen there. You can't tell me that this is good. And talking to these people, and especially, like I said, the younger women scare me, is that they're still going to be doing this in 25 years. You know, there's going to be 50-year-old women who, or men, who should not be stripping online for aesthetic purposes, who are still doing it, who are making one third of the money they're making today, but they're not doing it for the money now, and they're not doing it then. They're doing it for what's upstairs. And that's why I think that that's going to be the legacy of OnlyFans in the pandemic. And the legacy of the pandemic is that, really, how different is it being a producer versus being a consumer when it comes to porn addiction? If you're just trying to fix what's wrong up here, who cares whether you're showing or looking if that's not what it's really about?
Yeah, that is a real thinker for the audience to think about. And I know you're going to be heavily involved in that conversation moving forward, Josh, when it comes to your content, your interviews that you do, and the books that you write. If people want to continue the conversation with you, where's the best place for them to head towards?
Yeah, hit my website. It's paddictrecovery.com. P as in porn, or post-betrayal trauma, or penguins or pickles. I can help you with anything that starts with P, but it has to start with P. I try to give a site that allows you to access not just my offerings, whether it's coaching, whether it's my books. I also have a lot of just content on there as far as resources. You know, questions answered from people who are outside of me. I do try to put up an article every week. If I can't do it, I have somebody write a guest article. It's really about the healthy sexuality, and I try to provide enough modalities that even if talking to me isn't the way for you to go, if you want to do research, if you want to, you know, get onto internet forums and talk to people because that's what you're most comfortable with, that's what your first step is, cool. I have all that information on my website that you'll find a way to start to engage with pornography addiction in a way that's most comfortable for you, especially if you have it. And of course, anybody who wants to contact me, if you have a question, I'm not going to charge you to answer a friggin' question. I want people to be helped. If you have any questions, feel free to contact me, because I know I had nobody to talk to. I had nothing out there. So I guess my penance is, and I was such a, I think the word is asshole younger in life with this stuff. And I was such a bad person and such a taker that I now try to be a giver. I now try to give back. I need to survive and eat and have a roof, but I just want to help as many people as I can with this issue, man or woman, because I know what it's like to be there. Hell, I lost 6 months of my life behind bars. It was very needed for me. It was very useful for me. But I don't want anybody else to have to get there. I think that you can take care of this well before I did, before it's too late. So visit paddictrecovery.com. You know, if I can get better, good Lord, anybody can.
I can see that you're doing really, really powerful and stimulating work for you, Josh. So thank you for that. Thank you for joining me today. The link for paddict.com will be in the links below, guys. Thank you once again for listening, and I'll be back to speak to you all again very, very soon.